Right, good evening. It's now Parshas Noach. So we're talking about Noah and the flood. And let's just look a little bit at the beginning of the Parsha. Eile toldot Noach. These are the generations of Noach. Noach ish tzadik. Noach was a righteous man. Tamim haya v'dohotav. He was pure in his generations. Et Elokim hitalech Noach. Noach walked with God. One of the things to notice in this phrase is the way you have the two words Noach in this verse, the two words Noach next to each other.
But it's also Nach, Noach, Nach, resting, and the Hitpael, Hitalech. It's with himself in his resting, in his inwardness.
Okay.
Which,
lovely, right,
which,
okay.
Which is...
Well, Judith, that's all consonant with what the Zohar says and how the discourse is going to explore this. One of the things in this first verse is the juxtaposition of the two words Noach, which the Zohar will focus on.
So that's how he got the moon.
And also the fact that Noach means rest, which is also an interesting aspect.
It's double, so it's very inward.
Mm. And then we have the idea that it says these are the generations of Noach, and instead of telling us about his children immediately, it tells us that he was a very good person. And so Rashi on this verse gives two explanations. He says, well, once he's been mentioned, you say something good about him. So if you mention a person, you should say something good about them. And then in the next verse it says, Vayoled Noach Shlosha Vanim. Noach gave birth with his wife Naama to three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. But the second explanation of Rashi is that the main toldot, the main generations of a person, are the mitzvot that they do. The good deeds of a person are their main generation. So when it says, these are the generations of Noach, and then it tells us he was a fine person doing good deeds, that's what it means by his generations. That's the progeny, the real progeny of a person.
But you've added with the help of his wife. It's not here in the Hebrew.
No, it doesn't say here in the Hebrew. It says a few verses earlier. Mm-hmm. It mentions Naama, and Rashi tells us that she was the wife of Noah.
It's a very strange to be the woman out of the people.
Well, vayoled, there are different words meaning to bear. So there's bearing as a husband, and there's bearing as a wife. So so this is the word which is used for a husband having progeny. But it's, in Hebrew, there are two words. There's actually a passage in Rashi where he discusses the use of the different verbs to bear a child, and whether it's the male causing to bear, or the sivayoled is actually a hifil,
yes,
which is causing to be born, holid.
Yes.
So it's not that he gives birth, it's that he causes to be born. So that's why we use the word bore in English. It says in English here, he fathered. Mm. That's the... Okay. So, if we turn over the page, we now have this discourse, which was actually said on Shabbat, Parshat Bereshit, in the second Hidvadut, the second Hasidic gathering on that day, 5751, that means 1990. And there were two gatherings that day. There was one, and then... I'm not quite sure how it was in actual fact, but there was a second gathering, maybe after the afternoon prayer, something like that. And at the afternoon prayer, they lain Noach, the next Sedra, and so the Rebbe then said a discourse about Noach. Maybe earlier he said a discourse about Bereshit. But here he said about Noach. And this is a Muga discourse. This is a discourse which was checked by the Rebbe. It was published at that time. The Rebbe said it on the Shabbat of Bereshit, and it was published a few days later, before Parshat Noach, so it was ready for people to study towards the Sedra Noach of that year. Okay, so let's have the Maima Nigun, the melody of the Maima, in order to help us enter the teaching. Yes. Oh, yo, yam, ba, yam, ba, yam, bum, oh, ya, ya, ram, ba, ram, oh, ya, yam, bum, ha, yam, bum, ba, yam, ba, yam, ba, yom, ha, yam, bum, 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 bum. Aho yam ba da dam ba yam ba bo ha ye da dam ba yam ba yo ha ye da dam ba ha ye da dam ba ho yam ba yam ba yam ba ba ha yam ba ba yam ba ba ho yam ba yo yam ba ba. Eile toldot Noach. Noach, these are the generations of Noach, and then repeating the word Noach. Omavaya Tzemach Tzedek b'ma'amaro dibar maschul zeh, and the Tzemach Tzedek, that's the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, living around 1850. He explained in his teaching with this beginning, the ma'ar shekatuv Noach, Noach shtei pa'amim hu, the fact that it says Noach twice, ki Noach hibchinat Shabbat, that Noach is the quality of Shabbat, as Judith said, rest. Uba Shabbat yeshtei b'chinot, and in Shabbat there are two aspects. K'may merazal, as the sages say, a famous saying, il malei meshamrin Yisrael shtei Shabbatot ke'ilchatan miyad nigalin. If only the Jewish people, if they would just keep two Shabbatot, according to the halacha, they would immediately be redeemed. So the idea of there being two Shabbatot, that indicates the Vayadua, it's known, the Perush Shtei Shabbatot, the idea of two Shabbatot, he, Shtei HaShabbatot SheYeshnam B'chol Shabbat. There are actually two types of Shabbat within one Shabbat. It's not talking about two different weeks, according to this explanation. That there is, in each Shabbat, there are two dimensions of Shabbat. And what are the two dimensions? Ma'ali de Shabta, v'yoma de Shabta. Erev Shabbat, Friday night, and Shabbat day. So the evening of Shabbat and the day of Shabbat. And the evening of Shabbat and the day of Shabbat, they have different spiritual qualities. V'lachein ne'eman Noach Noach shtei pa'amim, and therefore it says Noach twice, Keneged Shtei HaShabbatot Shebechol Shabbat, corresponding to the two types of Shabbat that there are within any Shabbat, Maile de Shabta V'yoma de Shabta, the eve of Shabbat and Friday night and the day of Shabbat. Umosif, but now, here we've already got this concept, the double name Noach, Noach being said twice, and Noach meaning rest, will also be mentioned. Umosif ba Maimon, he adds in the discourse, the Perush Zeh Shenoach Hu Shabbat, the explanation that Noach represents Shabbat, Hu Al Pi De'ita B'Midrash, as we learn in the Midrash, the Noach, Noach Shtei Pa'amim, the fact that the word Noach is said twice, Hu Naichel Lo V'Naichel Lo Olam, rest and pleasantness. Naichel also means pleasantness. Pleasantness for him, and pleasantness for the world. It's like giving pears. One pear is pleasantness for him and pleasantness for the world. Naichel avot v'naichel avanim. Pleasantness for the fathers, the ancestors, and pleasantness for the sons. Naichel elyonim. Pleasant for the upper realms. V'naichel tachtonim. And pleasant for the lower worlds. Naichel b'olam hazeh. pleasant in this world, pleasant in the world to come. So he gives a whole lot of pairs, and in each pair, Noach represents the ability to straddle both those dimensions. So the idea, Eile told us, Noach, the repetition of the word Noach, that is indicating a quality which is able to straddle two dimensions at once, and there are a whole lot of different pairs of dimensions which could be cited.
Is it deliberate that it's part Yiddish and part Hebrew?
It's part Aramaic and part Hebrew.
Ah, that's not
sometimes a mimer. See, the mimer is actually said in Yiddish. And when it's said in Yiddish, there are many quotations in Hebrew and some which are in Aramaic. When the mimer is written down, it's written down usually in Hebrew. So this is a Hebrew transcript, edited by the Rebbe who said the mimer, but it's a Hebrew transcript. However, there are some words which are quotations from the Zohar, for example, and other places, and from the Talmud or the Midrash, which are in Aramaic, because the Talmud is a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic, and so is the Midrash. And the Zohar is mostly in Aramaic. So there's a lot of Aramaic in our traditional text. So the Tanakh is mostly in pure Hebrew, except for certain passages in Daniel and the Book of Ezra, which are in Aramaic. But most of our other texts, the Mishnah is also mostly in Hebrew, but most of our other texts are a mixture of our classical texts, are mixtures of Hebrew and Aramaic. The commentaries, like a commentary by Rashi, that's in Hebrew. Those are in Hebrew. So these words, naicha, these are like a word with an aleph at the end. That's a typical Aramaic form. Now, umayma zeda midrash, this statement in the midrash, Noach ilushon naicha, that Noach means naicha, comfort or rest. Kolel gama perush also includes the explanation, Shenoach hu bechinat Shabbat, that Noach represents Shabbat. About Shabbat it says God rested on the seventh day. So the resting, vayanach v'yom ashri, that resting is also a word like Noach. It's similar in form. The Noach shtei pa'amim, and the double expression of Noach, the word Noach, the name Noach, Heim Shabbat Tata v'Shabbat Ilah. Here we are back in Aramaic. The lower Shabbat and the upper Shabbat. Sheheim Maile deShabta v'Yom deShabta, which is what is meant by Friday night or Erev Shabbat and the day of Shabbat. So we have all these pairs of Shabbat. V'Yesh Lomar, and one might suggest Ma'atayim Imalzer, that one of the reasons, Shemava Od Pam, that the Tzemach Tzedek repeats this explanation about Noach twice and two types of Shabbat, after he's already said, he quotes from the Midrash that Noach is Shabbat, what that he says again a second time, Shenoach Heimayle Deshabta V'Yoma Deshabta, that Noach is the eve of Shabbat and the day of Shabbat, who is b'chdei l'ramez, in order to indicate, to hint, sha'shaychut ha'perush sheba'amayma im ha'perush sheba'midrash, the connection of the explanation in the discourse of the Tzemach Tzedek with the explanation in the Midrash, hu b'nogeya l'noach, is concerning Noach himself. So the mizeh shenoach ulushon naicha muchach shenoach ubechinat Shabbat, and from the fact that Noach means rest, that indicates the connection of Noach with Shabbat. Ubenagei leNoach Noach shtei pa'amim, and concerning the fact that Noach is twice, the haperu shebamayma shenoach Noach him Shabbat tata v'Shabbat ilah, the idea that the two words Shabbat represent the two aspects of Shabbat. Who al derech perush ha-midrash, Noach Noach, heim naicha le'elyonim ve'naicha le'tachtonim. that the two words Noach are the pleasantness above and the pleasantness below. What's happening here is a kind of exercise in intertextuality, where we have the concept of the word Noach being repeated and is taken by the Midrash in a particular way, with all kinds of pairs of opposites. And then also the idea of Shabbat, which is then being linked to which is being linked to the fact that there are two types, there are two dimensions of Shabbat. That is being interleaved with the two aspects of Noach. So it's a subtle Torah counterpoint here, where two things are being added together, the Midrash and the discourse of the Tzemach Tzedek, where he's taking, and which really goes back to the Zohar, that there are two aspects of Noach, and there are two aspects of Shabbat, and they are being blended together. And so from this we get a whole lot of different dimensions of pairs, which Noach represents, that it's good on one level, level A, and it's good on level B. On an, each one, there's an A and a B level, and the same thing is being applied to Shabbat. There's an A and a B level of Shabbat. There's the eve of Shabbat, and there's the day of Shabbat. So that is being brought into the mixture. So it's as if we're merging different interpretations, and they are merging around the double name Noach, Noach.
Of course, there is the obvious connection that the ark rested.
The ark rested.
Yeah, at the end of the flood with Noach. He sent out the thing and he said, surely this must mean that the ark has rested. That's a direct connection.
Batanachateva, the ark rested. Yeah, that's true. The ark rested.
That's the same
like
word.
It stopped floating. It rested on the ground. Another one could say is that in the ark, it was an atmosphere like in the world to come. It was a very special atmosphere in the ark. In the ark were all the different animals, which normally would fight with each other. But in the ark, they were at peace together. So the ark represents a kind of a spiritual domain like the world to come. And Shabbat also represents Me'ein Olam Haba, we call it, a little bit like the world to come. So here is a merging of images in a number of ways.
Can I ask you a question about the name Noah?
Yeah.
How much? It's actually a general question about Tanakh. How much do you believe that names of characters in Tanakh are actually there? Were their names, or how much were they given to them? In other words, that the names, almost like a literary device, that the names suited the people and suited the text.
Well, they all the people that we see mentioned in Tanakh are very significant people, whether they're significant in a positive way or in a negative way, or an apparently negative way. And certainly the Tanakh itself very often makes a big fuss about their name. I mean, for example, with Avraham and Sarah, their names originally were Avram and Sarai, and God deliberately changes their names and makes a whole thing about them. Now their name is being changed, and that goes together with getting Brit Milah for Avraham, and there's enormous significance put on that.
So the names, same contain, with Jacob. The names contain God, actually.
Well, it's containing God is one thing, but it's also other levels of meaning, other levels of explanation of the new name. And with Jacob and Israel, Jacob wrestled with the angels, so he was given the name Yisrael, which means wrestling with God, with a spiritual being.
And so
all the names are significant. From the point of view of Tanakh, names of people and also of places are significant, and sometimes a name is given of a place where Rashi says it wasn't actually called that at that time. That's later on it was called that.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay, names and places, I agree with that.
Yeah.
So I'm asking the same question
yeah.
about people.
Whereas with people, well, I mean, look, if the Torah tells us that, I mean, Noach's name is given to him when he was born, and then there's a verse about that.
How do we know that?
Well, it says it in the Torah. The same way we know of the existence of Noah, we know that his name was Noah.
But can't we look at all that part, for which there's no archaeological evidence, as mythological and deeply significant in terms of all these perishim?
Well, why shouldn't it be true? You see, literally true. The question, the problem with the word myth, is that myths are things that everyone knows, are stories of some kind. They maybe are very deep in this way or in that way.
Man needed God.
But in Hebrew, in Jewish teaching, there is a reality. The Torah is actually the reality. The archaeological evidence is an approximation to the Torah.
Okay, but without questioning the divine nature of Torah, or even the fact that Torah was given by God, I'm not questioning that. What I'm actually saying is that that doesn't preclude the names being changed to suit the stories.
Yes, you're right. And there are occasions when we don't know what the real name is and we're given a different name.
Yeah. Ish or something, it says
the man.
Yeah, the man came, it says, with where does it say that? With Yitzchak, who went up.
It's when Joseph meets a man.
Yeah, they went to look for his brothers.
Yes.
Yeah, a man came.
Because there's lots of names in Tanakh also. I'm thinking the story of Horton and Boaz and all that. The names have meaning appertaining to the characters. I can't
remember. Not only do the names have meaning appertaining to the characters, the words have meaning in relation to what they're about. For example, just today I discovered from Likutei Torah by Rabbi Shlomo Zalman, the word Ein Sof has the numerical value, which means the infinite, has the numerical value Or, light. So Or, Ein Sof, is actually light, light.
Which is where we began.
Yes.
It doesn't necessarily mean that these guys, that was necessarily their names. That's all I was trying to say. So Noach's name might have been, like Moshe, for example, is I understand, from Motse.
Well, no, it's his. The princess called him Moshe.
Mm.
What we don't know is what Yocheved, his mother, called him before he rescued by the princess. See, the princess gave him a name called Moshe.
Was Motse from Motse?
No, she said, that's right.
Because I drew him up from the water.
Yes.
See, the princess said that. Now there's a whole discussion. What did the princess actually say? Didn't she say something in Egyptian?
Of course.
Would she speak in Hebrew? So there's a whole discussion what Moshe's name really was.
Yes.
But the fact is that the first time we encounter a name for him is the Egyptian princess giving him a name, and we don't know if he had a name earlier on.
Mm-hmm. I was told that Moshe meant Mashiach.
That's another level of interpretation. You see, that's what the straightforward biblical text says: the princess called him Moshe, and the word Moshe means drawing him out of the water. See, it actually gives an explanation for the name, and we don't know of any other name for
him. So, going back to Noach, for example, as you rightly say, it's also Lach or Lanoch. It says, doesn't it, that he was righteous in his generation?
Yeah.
Which we all know, I think, here, that means that he was righteous relative to his generation.
Right.
So he was actually somebody who was comfortable in the sense of not
that's very
raising
condemnatory.
Okay, but that's the explanation I was understood.
With exactly. Not tormented by conscience, isn't that
exactly,
what you meant?
Exactly. Not having to draw himself that level higher. Rich,
of course, that's what you mean by
No. Michael doesn't mean rich, but he means that if he would have been less satisfied, he might have moved to a higher level, like Abraham. The difference between Noah and Abraham is described as the difference. You see, what did Noah do? There was a terrible evil in the world, and so Noah
and his family.
He and his family were saved. Whereas Abraham tried to improve people. And so if Noah would have taken more of a leaf out of Abraham's book, he would have tried to improve the world instead of just saving himself and his family. So that's like a criticism.
That's the explanation that's usually given, isn't it? Of he was
Righteous in his generation. Well, that's the
Hasidic... Therefore, Noah in his generation.
Yeah, you see, there's a midrashic statement that in his generation he was righteous, but compared with Abraham, he wouldn't be considered so righteous. Then comes the question, what's the difference between him and Abraham? And I think it's the Hasidic explanation that points out the difference, that Noah saved himself, whereas Abraham was concerned for those
around him. And therefore he was comfortable with himself, with his own righteousness.
So you can read it in a negative.
He didn't only save himself.
Yeah, that's a good explanation.
The world would have
that's
been extremely depleted Russia didn't if he hadn't saved every other
Russia
thing.
Russia didn't say that.
Okay, wait a second. Judith doesn't accept it because he saved all the animals as well.
Everything in the
world. Yeah, all right, that's
well,
a good
thing. That was innocent, in other words.
But the animals were innocent. The idea is that if he would have been put a bit more effort into communicating with other people and saying to them, you have to change, that it's not right for people to live in this way, I'm going to make a talk for 1,000 people and we're going to talk about the seven laws of Adam, the six laws. There were six laws from Adam, the seven Noahide laws, because one extra law was given to Noah.
What was that?
Not to eat the blood of a living animal, because Adam, till Noah, everyone was vegetarian. So he could have done more to communicate. You know, he could have had a website.
He wouldn't have been. He wouldn't have been accepted as a good.
You can argue with that as well, because thanks to Abram or Abram's offspring. Well, I suppose they're also Noah's.
Yeah.
Noah was just going into.
But I mean, also philosophically,
they're also saving the world by killing the world at present.
No, but philosophically, they're very different as well, aren't they? Because Noah is. Again, comfortable with what he does, whereas Abraham is the first monotheist.
Yeah, and monotheism is not an issue in Noah's time. The main problem in Noah's time was violence and rapacity.
Right, but what I'm saying is Abraham took it a step further.
Yes.
In philosophical terms.
You know, yes,
forgetting religion.
Abraham was in a worse situation theologically his time, because they'd forgotten about the nature of God, and so Abraham had to discover God for himself.
He wasn't exactly the first monotheist, actually. I think there were Egyptians who were monotheists, but they hadn't got quite to the level of believing in a God. They believed in the sun as the God,
That's taking the word monotheism very literally.
Yes.
Monotheism doesn't just mean you believe in one God.
No.
It means you believe in the one God who is the inner reality of all existence.
People had toyed with the concept, but they hadn't reached the higher level.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a very that's a very big gap. But according to Maimonides, at an earlier period, everyone was monotheist. The problem is that they. Adam. Yes, Cain, Abel. See, even Cain, who killed Abel, believed in one God.
He was frightened of God.
Yeah, that's right.
That's very true.
So, and Abraham, Maimonides describes a very interesting process how idolatry began.
Yeah, they went off the track. They started. But that's very interesting. The intermediaries.
Yes.
Right.
But I mean, there is a difference though between Adam and his generation and children, etc., and Abraham, because actually Adam's generation sort of intrinsically believed in God, the way I see it.
Adam's generation.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Whereas Abraham intellectually believed in God.
Well, Abraham was brought up as an idolater.
I know that.
His father sold idols. His father,
right?
Yes.
Yes, but so he actually went through an intellectual process as what?
Of discovery.
Yeah, yes. That's right. Yeah.
Whereas the other guys, the earlier ones, just, they were innocent in a sense. You know, they just believed in God because...
Yes, I mean, know? God was obvious at that earlier period. Well, whereas by the time you get to Abraham, most people were in error. There were people who did believe in God in Abraham's
time. Well, the
time.
World is more sophisticated.
For example, there was Melchizedek, who was Abram's great-great-grandfather, and Melchizedek was Shem, the son of Noah, who was still alive in Abraham's time. Now, he believed in God. He was a Kohen Lekel Elyon. He was a priest to the high God. So there was actually a person who was like a religious
spirit. And if you look at the name Melchizedek, it's king of
righteousness. Yes. And he was the king of a place called Shalem, king of Shalem, Jerusalem. Well, he was the king of Jerusalem. So, and Abraham, when he meets Melchizedek, which we see, not in this Sedra, in a later Sedra, he gives him a tenth of what he has, because he recognizes him as a priest, as a sacred person. So you have monotheists. In fact, later on, we see Jacob studying in the yeshiva of Shem and his grandson Ever. So Shem and Ever. So you have teachers who are from a pre-Abrahamic time, who are still alive in Abraham's time and afterward, who are very spiritual people and aware of one God. So Noah's aware of one God. The question is, how do you manifest your belief in God? How does that come down into the practicality of the world? And one of the comparisons that's made is between two kinds of tzaddik. The tzaddik in a fur coat and the tzaddik who lights the fire. It's a cold day. And so one kind of tzaddik puts on a fur coat so he's warm. Or she's warm. And another kind of tzaddik lights the fire so that everyone becomes warm. You see, that distinction, that seeing of one's sphere of responsibility as being wider or global, that's part of the difference. Now, there's another issue here about names. It is said that today, when parents give a name to a child, they have a moment of prophetic insight that they give a name which matches their child. And it's very interesting. And I've known it to work in a negative way, where you meet someone who has like some problem, and then you speak to the parents, and they say, yes, we named him after so-and-so, and we shouldn't have done so-and-so in our family. He was a very difficult person, and he's now got that name, and look how he behaved. You know? So.
Yeah, that's why I was going to ask, whether the name affects the nature of the person. That's a very interesting...
Yes.
It's what you started off by saying.
It's Yisro, who worshipped all the different... religions, he had lots and lots of names.
Yes.
And so it's not too much of a jump of the imagination. No, but as he changed names. You know,
because what you said to begin with was not what you said afterwards, actually. It's what you said to begin with, you know, what you said about the person getting the name that suits them, but then that the name actually influences person.
That might it may work both ways around. The name influences how the person is, and the person's inner nature.
Yeah,
I mean, the question is, could the parents have given a different name
and changed the name?
Could they ever have given a different name? That was the name the child had to have.
But you know, there's also research that shows when parents give children difficult names at school the children tend to excel more than children with easy names. It's very interesting.
They tend to...
In English schools, for example.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So the children, for example, have a difficult name.
Yeah.
that the other children tease them about or excludes them slightly, those children tend to be higher achievers than children called John and Paul and
whatever. Oh, you mean because they're challenged?
Yes.
No, because they're isolated from the
from
etc. So they've got more time to study.
Yeah. No one phones them up, so they
exactly.
do their
little jobs.
Yeah.
Back to
the
mathematics.
Yes.
The Shabbat evening.
Yes.
Shabbat day. You were talking of it at a different level of blurring the two-ness that becomes united. And I was thinking of it in terms of going back to psychoanalytic theory of blurring of inner distinctions of awarenesses, of unconscious becoming conscious and inner becoming outer, or outer becoming inner, and allowing for this porosity, as it were, or interpenetration of these things because of being receptive, because you can look at Nach as also being receptive.
That's interesting. See, the way this discourse proceeds is that it says you start off with two types of Shabbat, Friday evening and Shabbat day. But then you move to Shabbat afternoon, which is called Riva de Riven, the delight of delights. And that Shabbat afternoon, which is the time of the third Shabbat meal and the afternoon prayer, that is a kind of a resolution of the two types of Shabbat. So it's a third quality, which is a unity of the two. And the discourse also connects that with the first temple, the second temple, which were destroyed, and then the third temple, which will be eternal. You know, so that sort of movement. Oh, so it's this polarity, and then the polarity being uniform.
Our second temple was already a third temple.
In what sense?
But there was another one that was built that was...
You mean the tabernacle, the Mishkan?
Yes.
Yeah, you had the tabernacle in the desert, and then it was set up in various different places in Israel. Then it came to Jerusalem. Now, once Jerusalem was the place of the sanctuary or temple, that's the only place it could be. So at that point, Solomon, David, wanted to build the temple there, and his son Solomon did. So there's the first temple, then comes the second temple. So it's usually spoken about in that way, even though the sanctuary is also a separate entity, you're quite right. But that is seen in its itinerant form. It hasn't yet come to its resting place, right? And which, in fact, it uses a verse in the Torah about that, El HaMenucha, that when the temple comes to its Menucha,
its resting
place, then that's where it has to be, which means coming to Jerusalem.
It's interesting that you were speaking about the two and the third. Sounds like Shnei Ksuvim HaMakrishim Zeh Zeh.
Yes.
In the Gemara it says you get two verses sometimes which contradict each other, and then the third one comes and reconciles between the difference between them. So Sally was saying the same, that the Friday night and then the Shabbos day and the third meal, the afternoon somehow reconciles the two. Very much sounds like a very strong parallel to me.
It's okay.
Well, we haven't learned it yet.
Yeah. Well, so let's follow through a little bit, and we'll see how far we can get. We're two lines from the bottom of this first page. Va'inyan hu, and the subject is as follows. Shemayda de Shabta, the eve of Shabbat is, the eve of the Shabbat is Aliyat HaMalchut, the ascent of Malchut. Malchut is kingship, the tenth sphira, and the ascent of Malchut, that's what it's called Kabbalistically. ba'avodat ha'adam, and what is that in the service of the person? Hu birur v'ha'alat ha'guf v'nefsha bahamid. That is the refining and elevation of the body and the animal soul. Tachdom sheba'adam. The lower part of the person. So the eve of Shabbat expresses the elevating of the lower part of the person, the more earthly part of the person, the body, the animal soul. V'yom de Shabbat, and the day of Shabbat, signifies, Kabbalistically, Hamshachat Zer Ampin, a flow of the upper Svirot, and that is Hu Hamshachat Hagilui, this is a drawing down of the revelation of Nefesh Elokit, the divine soul, Elyon Sheba Adam, the upper part of the person. Now, let's just try and see this diagrammatically. We have Malchut, which is being elevated. We have the Zeh Ampin, which is, let's just call it the Sefirot, which are moving downwards. And in the middle, we've got the two parts of Shabbat, as it were. And so the unification of Malchut, the movement up of Malchut, you see there's a process of unification taking place. Malchut and the Sefirot, which represent male, as it were, and Malchut is female, so there's going to be a unification here. And the two aspects of Shabbat, the lower, the first aspect of Shabbat is the elevation of Malchut, and then comes the expression of the Sefirot flowing downwards, and this represents in the person two different dimensions of the person. The lower level of the person, which is being absorbed into holiness, and the higher level of the person, which is flowing with holiness.
And you could call male and female elements in everyone.
Well, you can call it that, yeah, because the Sefirot and Malchut, yeah, which are being united together. Va'al yedei she'Yisrael shomrim shtei ha-shabbatot, and from the fact that the Jewish people keep both Shabbaton, shal yedei ze na'aseh ha-menucha, from which comes the peace. Menucha. And what does it mean, peace? Peace me'ha'inyanim ha-mevalbelim ha'avodat Hashem. Peace from the things which confuse and disturb service of God. Hein ba'tachton sheba'adam, whether in the lower part of the person, vein ba'elyon sheba'adam, or in the higher part of the person. Al yedei ze nimshach gilui hamenucha milamayla b'chol ha'olamot. Through that menucha is revealed, peace is revealed from above in all the worlds. Ba'elyonim uvatachtonim, in the upper worlds and in the lower worlds. Naicha la'elyonim, now going back, quoting what we said before, peace in the upper worlds, pleasantness in the upper worlds, peace in the lower worlds. So this junction really achieves a flow through all realms, upper realms and lower realms, that there is this flow of peace which is there flowing through into all worlds.
It's the same aspiration actually in Zen meditation, still mind in still body, which is nafagin in all forms of Buddhism. Which is, to me, very fascinating.
Well, one explanation of the religions of the East, which I'm sure you've heard, is that Abraham had a wife called Keturah, who the sages say is actually Hagar, after the passing away of Sarah, and she had children, and he sent them off to the East, and he gave them presents. And so, in other words, he gave them presents that they wouldn't argue with his son Yitzhak and try to claim inheritance. But in fact, he gave them presents, and were the presents? Something spiritual teaching. So they took these spiritual teachings, and so you have that's the Jewish globally chauvinist view of that everything has a Jewish source.
Everything derived from Buddhism.
Buddhism, Taoism. I don't see it from Hinduism.
No, there is actually...
Because it's a religion, and Buddhism isn't.
There is actually an old...
Look, I live in the Zazen for a month.
But it's not a religion, Buddhism.
It is a religion.
Well, there is actually an old there is an old Hebrew text called Ben HaMelech VaHaNazir, the prince and the and the Nazirite.
Monk.
Yeah, which is a basic story. That's a medieval Hebrew text.
Is there a reason that it's, you said the Tachtonim somewhere? Where's the.
Well, Olamot, there's.
Olamot Tachtonim.
Yes, Elyonim and Tachtonim, upper worlds and lower worlds.
Yes, it's plural.
Right. Right. That's right. Lower worlds in the plural. Ubiya bet ubiya in yam bepchat yoter, and explaining this in more detail, yuvin bahagdim amavu b'chama mekomot, will be understood by citing something which is written in a number of places. Yishtei Shabbatot sheyeshnam b'chol Shabbat, the idea of the two Sabbaths which there are in each Shabbat, shayich lezeh shekol iska de Shabbat kaful. Everything we do on Shabbat is double. There's like a double thing, two chalot. You know, there's a doubleness about
that's
Shabbat.
Where it comes from.
That's
the two chalot.
If you go back, where is the source of the two chalot? Is the idea that they got a double portion of manna on Friday? But nonetheless, there's this concept of double, two chalot, two the minimum of two candles usually.
The double helix, everything a double.
And that's why it says, if only the Jewish people would keep two Shabbatot properly, they would be redeemed. The double concept relates to the redemption. And we see this in an interesting midrash about the double letters. There are double letters in the Hebrew alphabet, which there's one form of the letter, a normal form, and then there's another form which is at the end of a word. Mansapach, mem nun sadik pei chaf. And so there is something mystical and mysterious about these letters, these double letters. That's right. So here we have, and in a Hasidic discourse of 1870, it links this idea of the double letters and the redemptive quality that there is in these double letters to the idea of the keeping of the two Shabbatot, the twice Shabbat. So it's somehow this doubleness, this this quality of doubleness.
Duplicity.
Well, duplicity means
means double.
Yeah, but in a negative way.
Saying one thing and thinking another.
But it's negative, isn't it? Duplicity.
Yes.
No. I mean,
no. Yeah. Well.
Way that
is it? That's used in other words.
All right. It's used here in England.
All right. Okay. So now we move on to the idea of ahava v'yira. The idea of love and fear. Do you see that at the beginning of the line? Ahava v'yira heim bichlalut ha'avodah shmitzad ha'neshama. This is in section Bet. Love and fear, they are the service of the soul, which is the day of Shabbat.
Why are you saying fear rather than awe?
All right, we could say awe. But we could...
Kind of nice.
Yes, except, I mean, we've often been through this exploration, the whole question of it. So the ahava and yira, in general, love and awe, represents the service of the soul, the day of Shabbat. The kiyum mitzvot masiyot, and the keeping of the practical mitzvot, is avodah mitzvah aguf, is the service from the level of the body, which is the eve of Shabbat. And the idea that the what we do on Shabbat is double, is that the Avat Hashem Shemitzad Neshama, the love of God coming from the soul, the upper part of the person, this has to be drawn down into the animal soul and the body, the lower part. As it says, Vahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavecha, you should love the Lord your God with all your heart. And the word levavecha is like a double word. It's not levavecha, your heart, but levavecha, meaning the positive aspect of the heart and also the negative. Sha'avat yeh b'chal alayimini mekom mishkan nefesh elokit, that it should be on the right hand part of the heart, which is where the divine soul dwells, and also or b'chal alasmali, in the left hand part. Mekom mishkan nefesh elokit.
It's also double. It's also called a double lamed, like levav.
Chalal. Okay, fair enough. Which is the place, the left-hand part, where the animal soul dwells. As the sages tell us, b'chol levavcha b'shnei yitzerecha, we have to serve God with our whole heart and love God with our whole heart, meaning with a good desire and with the evil desire. That the whole part of the person, the spiritual part of the person and the animal part of the person, should both be enthusiastically involved in serving God. V'yetecha mizu, and more than that, b'chol navshecha, with your whole soul, sha'ava mitpashetet b'chol hakochot ve'evarim, the love spreads through all the forces of the person, the limbs of the person. And he gives an example, like someone running to do a mitzvah. So a person's running to do something good, so they're running, it's all their effort, all their energy, everything is there involved in that mitzvah. V'yetera mizu, b'chol mo'odecha, you even love God with all your all, the word mo'odecha, that the love of God is drawn and is expressed not only in the person, but as it's explained, b'chol mo'odecha, b'chol mo'moncha, with all one's wealth, with all one's possessions, that everything one has is somehow being used to serve God. Now, this is in the Shema, v'siyuma parshahu, in the end of the paragraph of the Shema, uchtavtama mezuzot betecha v'shelecha, you should write these words on the mezuzot of your entrances of your house. Shal yedeha mezuzah shekoveh bepetach beiton, through the mezuzah which is fixed at the entrance of one's house, nikah she'ashem echad, it's recognized that the one God, Hu HaMoshel, he is the ruler, Hu HaShomer et HaBayit, he guards the home, V'chol HaShebetocho, and everything within it, V'Shomer et HaAdam gam etzeso mibeto, and God guards the person also when he goes out of the house, HaShem Yishmat Seitcha uVo'acha me'ato ad olam, God should guard your going out and your coming in from now and forever. And so in the other way, looking at it the other way, here we've been talking about the quality of love and fear permeating everything, enthusiasm, this spiritual stroke, emotional enthusiasm, which permeates everything one does. Also, shekiyum mitzvot ha-masiyot, that the keeping of the practical mitzvot, which is the service on the side of the body, that also has to have love and awe, which is the service of the soul. So in other words, the service of the soul, from its point of view, we could look at it in the same diagram. The service of the soul has to permeate everything downwards. But also the practicalities that we do, which we might just do because we're doing it, that ideally has to be infused with spirituality. Now we're actually going to go, if we manage, this mimer takes a step beyond that, but we will see. Now we're up to paragraph 3. It continues in the discourse that mincha of Shabbat and the seuda shlishit of Shabbat is actually higher than the two dimensions of Shabbat that we've talking about. So much so that compared with this, the two Shabbatot, they are really the same, and the mincha, the third level, is on a higher dimension altogether. Now this relates to the fact that in the Ten Commandments, there are two versions of the Ten Commandments. One it says Zachor Yom HaShabbat, the other one it says Shamor. God, remember the Sabbath day, and guard the Sabbath day. And the remember and the guarding are the two dimensions of Shabbat. The remembering is the day, and the guarding is the evening. Because the remembering, Zachor, relates to the male, Mashpia, the flowing from above to below, and the Shamor, the guarding, is like the feminine, which is receiving, and that's the evening of Shabbat. So there's the flow from below to above, and from above to below. And compared with the revelation of what happens at Mincha on Shabbat, the Mashpia, the one giving the flow, and the one receiving the flow are equal. Zachor v'shamor b'dibur echad. This is what the sages tell us, that the two words, guard and remember and guard, were said with one word. Now it's that one unity that we are now looking at, this third dimension, where everything is one. And this can be connected with the idea that on Mincha of Shabbat, in the afternoon prayer of Shabbat, we say, Ki me'itcha hi menuchatam. Their rest comes from you. Now, if you look at the very last page of this pack of material, you actually have a section which comes from the afternoon prayer of Shabbat. Mincha for Shabbat. Okay, Anthony, would you like to read in English? Our God and God of our fathers.
Are you talking about the yellow view?
No, here. It's, oh no, sorry, not our God and God of our fathers. It's, take it from the top line. A rest of love and generosity.
Tell me, what's the Hebrew that we're translating?
Menuchat Ava Nadava. No, you've only got one page, I think. Oh, you've got two pages. Oh, I see, right, it's in the second page. Sorry. Menuchat Ava Nadava, a rest of love and generosity.
Right. Menuchat Ava Nadava, a rest of love and generosity, a rest of truth and faithfulness, a rest of peace, serenity and security, a perfect rest with which you find favor. Carry on. May your children recognize and know that from you is their rest, and by their rest they sanctify your name.
Right, from you is their rest. This is said in the afternoon prayer. Ki me'itcha hi menuchatam. From you are their rest. So in other words, the rest is coming from God. It's a spiritual dimension coming from God. Back in that, in the discourse, in that first paragraph of chapter 3, Himitcha, this quality of rest, which is revealed at the third dimension of Shabbat, the afternoon of Shabbat, this is something coming from you, Meitcha Mamash, from the very essence of godliness. And this rest includes the day of Shabbat and the eve of Shabbat, the remembering and the guarding all together. Now, one can suggest as follows, that the idea of Zachor and Shamor, which are unified in one word, in the service of the person, is that the keeping of the mitzvahs, not because that he is accustomed to do the mitzvah, which is the lower level, and not, in other words, it's habits. See, there are different ways you could do a mitzvah. One way is habit. You do the mitzvah just habitually, that's how you do the mitzvah, and that is sort of the lower level. That's, you know, the body is sort of, it's in a certain pattern. So it's just going to keep that pattern. That's this lower aspect. Now then there's another aspect as well, the higher aspect over here. The person wants to express their love for God. Now that sounds very spiritual, very beautiful. But they're doing the mitzvah because they want to express their love for God. There's a third level. that the reason for doing the mitzvah is because of the mitzvah itself. Mitzad ha-mitzvah atzma. Because of the mitzvah itself, mitzvah meloshon tzavta b'chibur, the word mitzvah meaning here connection and bond. The person bonds with the radiance of the infinite who commands the mitzvah. And that is above the dimensions of lower and upper. The body and the soul. And it includes both of them. So in other words, there's a further dimension in keeping mitzvah. The body doing the mitzvah because it's trained to do the mitzvah, so the body is comfortable. The person doing the mitzvah because that's how they express their love of God, so the soul is comfortable. Lovely. So it's another form of comfort. You know, there are physical armchairs and spiritual armchairs. But here, the third dimension is doing the mitzvah because the mitzvah is a bond with the infinite. And so that is the level that we're trying to reach, which is above the distinction between lower and upper. It's something else. Above the distinction between body and spirit. An actual connection to the infinite. And that is a kind of a root level of connection within the soul of the individual relating to the oneness of God. And that special quality that we have in the third dimension of Shabbat, expressing this quality, and that is something which then extends through the person and all aspects of their life. And if we just move towards the end. If we move to Hey, section 5, and that's what it means, these are the generations of Noach. Noach, repeating the name Noach, the reason why it says Noach twice is because, and it says these are the generations of Noach, because the true nature of Noach being said twice is, these are the peace which is above and the peace below. They are the one nekudah, the one dot which includes both of them. And the revelation of this is the real generations of Noach. Because the generations of the righteous are the good deeds. And so therefore it's the mitzvot which come from the third dimension. The mitzvot which are really from the essence of the person relating to the essence of God. That is the generations of Noach. And one could say, why does it say this about Noach? Because Noach relates to the whole idea of repentance. In fact, the service of Noach caused God to say, I will never bring another flood. Talking about the levels of Noach, in fact, it's in relation to Noach that God said, I will never bring another flood, I will never cause the universe to stop in the way that it stopped at that point. Because through tshuva, there's a revelation of the essence of the soul. And that's why it says about Noach, this Noach, Noach, this double quality. And each one of them includes both. And that also relates to what the sages talk about, repentance and good deeds. Because through repentance, the deeds which a person does, which could be Maisa Mitzvah, the action of Mitzvah, they become good, they become radiant. That the actions themselves are the body of the mitzvah, and the radiance, the fact that they are good is the radiance and the life force in the mitzvah. And through repentance, which is a revealing of the essence of the soul, the action of the mitzvah, they become radiant, because they're shining in them the intention, which is something deeper, which comes from the essence of the soul. And then, So there we have the idea of this double quality which extends into a third level, unifying them all, which is the real menucha, the real peace. So we have the two dimensions of Noach, the upper level of Noach, and the lower level of Noach, and then we have ki mi'itcha hi menuchatam, from you is their peace, which is the real final a quality, which is the generations of Noach spreading into the mitzvot and expressing mitzvot as a bond with God. And may it be your will, the will of God, says the Rebbe, that since we are now at the time of the third meal, Suda Shlishit of Shabbat, which relates to the Mincha of Shabbat, and the reading of the Torah is Eile Toldat Noach, Noach, this menucha, this peace, should be from anything which confuses us from service of God, whether it's physical things or spiritual things, and since the whole world is in the heart of each person, through this there will be brought this kind of menucha through all worlds. If we achieve this level of menucha, of peace, since the world, the universe, is inside each of us, this menucha, this peace, will spread through all worlds. The comforts, for the upper worlds, comfort for the lower worlds, and more than that, just as Noah saw a new world when the ark finally rested, and he came out of the ark and he saw a new world, so we too should have the merit that we will also see a new world. Shamayim Chadashim, a new heavens and a new earth, as the prophet Yeshaya says, and especially after the reading of the Torah in the morning of Bereshit Bara Lakim et Hashemayim et Haaretz, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, that through reading that in the Torah, which we did last week, we achieve that God creates afresh the heavens and the earth and all their hosts, and very swiftly should be the building of the third temple that corresponds to Jacob. There's Abram and Isaac and Jacob, and in that third temple is included the first temple and the second, like Abram and Yitzhak, like the two types of Shabbat, the first temple and the second, and then the third quality, which is the inheritance of Jacob, including the other part of Shabbat, the eve of Shabbat and the day of Shabbat, and all unified together, and this should be very soon now.
Mm-hmm. He came up with a very original idea, but in the Mamo he says it differently. He says the Noseh Lozeshah Yonaycha B'chol HaOlamos, that Noah rested in all the worlds. What does he mean by that?
It's not Noah resting. It's that Naicha means comfort, means pleasantness. Noah represents a pleasantness in all the worlds.
In all the worlds, he means the upper worlds and the lower worlds.
Yeah. But you mean at the end?
He's
at the end, the Menucha, yeah. Through us achieving this point of connection with the Divine, Kimi at Itcha hi Menuchatam, from God himself, yeah. From the very essence of God, is this rest. And that rest, in its most positive state, that manifestation of connection with God, should spread through all the worlds. So the world shouldn't be a concealment of God, it should be a revelation of God in the most beautiful.
So that was a quality of Noah, according to this, we can take it literally, that Noah was a great man.
Well, certainly he was a great man.
Why should there be the...
Yeah, I mean, look, the sages are able to criticize one person corresponding to, in comparison with another, but they're both great men.
Yeah. To be fair, in the Gemara, it's an argument. Some people say it was very, very good that it says Noah was good in his generation.
In spite of Abraham, if Abraham would have been in his generation, he wouldn't have been able to survive.
Sorry?
Judith, respect her ancestor. No one's going to talk against Judith.
He said something very interesting. Very, very good. He worked out his own pshat. He said that Noah, the expression of Noah, is like we said, Yesh Doshim Lignai, that Noah was happy to rest at his level.
Right.
That he didn't go and try to get everybody else religious. He just rested and he said, well, I'm happy, I'm religious, and that's it. I'll get in my boat and I'll be all right. I think it's a very good, I haven't seen it anywhere else.
Yeah.
So it's completely original. Excellent. Excellent.
On the other hand, there is also the whole spiritual dimension of what Noah achieved, that there in the ark was the spiritual atmosphere of the world to come. And this real, the window in the ark, which some say was a window and some say was a precious stone, which was radiant. Mm.
And all these animals behaving.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
just like in the time of Mashiach, that the wolf will dwell with the lamb.
I was going to say, one thing we missed out on our discussions, for some reason we started talking about names, you know, when the names affect the nature. Well, two things we missed out of the discussion. The first thing is that Adam called all the animals their names.
Right.
And he called them... Adam was a very clever person, and he called all the names that... I think the Gemara says, according to their...
Names.
He called the names according to the nature of the animal.
Yeah.
Mm.
Right, so that's one way. And now the other thing which we left out is a Gemara which says... your way about whether the name affects the nature of a person, that if a person becomes very ill, the Gemara says, one thing, if you go to the doctor, if the doctor can't do anything, you're about to give up hope, what you should do is change his name. Because the Gemara says that possibly a change of name will change his muscle. It's a Gemara.
I have actually met people in Israel who changed their name.
Yeah.
Well, no,
not
so much.
So this indicates. Yeah. So you've got a clear. I've brought you a clear indication from a Gemara, an answer, if you like, to your question, that a change of name can change the person.
Right.
You know.